Okay. So last week we talked about contracts and contract law, just kind of the basics of it. And so what we want to do today is, because again, the work you guys are going to do as architects, and if you guys work for a contractor, the work people do with contractors, are all going to be driven by the contracts that are written. And so, as I've said a couple times, and I'll say throughout the semester, you can't ever have a perfect contract. You can't ever have a contract that has every single term about how to build a building in it. It just would be just way too long. Just like architects aren't expected to draw perfect drawings. I want you guys to know that. Like, there's, and we'll talk about this again in and out throughout the semester. Contractors have to guarantee their work. Architects never guarantee their work. Architects perform their work to the applicable standard of care, which means you're doing your best job, and similar, we'll talk about standard of care, it'll come up in some of our terms, and that'll be a defined term that we'll talk about, but it's similar to an architect of similar skill practicing in a similar location on a similar building. So there's all these kind of, I won't say wiggle rooms, but it's not a guarantee. But contracts still have to give the rules to the game. There still have to be some guardrails, some guidelines, and everything else. And so you sign a contract with your client as an architect, or the contractor signs a client with a contract as a contractor, and they're performing the duties. What happens when I, as the architect, say, this is what I thought I'm supposed to do, and you, as the owner, say, no, this is what I thought you were supposed to do? So even though there's the written word, it's not going to have everything in detail. So there's going to have to be some rules on how to interpret the rules, if that makes sense. So we're going to talk about the interpretation of contracts. What do you do when there's this discrepancy between, and how do we learn to read contracts? How do we understand how they work? That's the first part. Then we're going to talk about what a breach of contract is, just the basics of what a breach is, and the damages that can come from as a result of the breach. And that's what we talk about, the remedies. Remedies are also damages. So if someone does breach the contract, and you've interpreted the contract correctly, saying what it means and what it doesn't mean, after the breach, what are the remedies that you guys could recover, or anybody that feels like they've been breached? So that's kind of the summary for today. So we're going to start first with just the interpretation of contracts. What we want to do, and this comes in, and we talked about this with judges and arbitration in the first day of class. The goal when you interpret the contract is to effectuate the intent of the parties, to get what is the understanding or the intent of the parties. You know, we talked about last week there had to be a meeting of the minds. Well, what was that meeting of the minds? And hopefully it's been clearly written into the agreement, but sometimes it's not. So when we get into a dispute, if you take it to court or you take it to arbitration, I think I talked about this, the trier of fact and the trier of law. The trier of fact is going to be, if there's a jury, those are the people that are going to listen to the facts and they're going to make a decision what the facts mean, what they understand the facts to mean. Trier of law is the judge, and they're going to say, well, this is how you take those facts and apply the law in this way. So they're going to tell you what to do with the roadmap or what have you. If there's no jury, because sometimes you can have what's called a bench trial, which is just the judge will be both the trier of facts and the trier of law. Or if you go to an arbitration, which we talked about, again, there's no jury in that, so the arbitration panel will be both the trier of fact and the trier of law. But when we're interpreting contracts, the trier of fact has to look to see, what is the bargain? What was that meeting of the minds? And they are not supposed to rewrite it. They're not supposed to say, well, sounds like this is what you did. This is what you really wanted. Because you might have two parties that say, I didn't think we were going to do this, and I didn't think we were going to do that, but they both might agree on, we thought we were going to do something else. Well, the judge or the jury or the arbitration panel, the trier of fact, can't rewrite it. If the contract says you're supposed to do A, and it's clear, that's what the trier of fact says it is. And it doesn't matter what either party says. I mean, one party may say, I thought I was going to do B, and the other party said I might do C, but if the contract says you're supposed to do A, that's what the trier of fact determines. And so that's what you're trying to do. Now, most of the time, you're not going to have that scenario where both parties are completely off what the goal and the intent is. Most of the time you're going to have like, it says A, and one party's going to be saying, well, I thought it was A and a little bit different, and I thought A meant a little bit that. So they're trying to figure out, but you have to stick with what the A is. You can't rewrite the contract. Now, how do we get there? How do we figure out, as the jury, the trier of fact, the people, how do we figure out what that contract means? And so the next part, the first level of analysis they're going to do, is they have to look objectively at what the words are, the actual meanings of the word, not subjective, what it feels like, but what does it exactly say? So under the rules is, and these are all based on case law, that over years and years and years, they've established these rules. And what we're taught as lawyers in the beginning, and what you guys should be told when you're working with lawyers or when you're drafting a contract, are some of these basic rules. And the thing about the law is some of it's kind of simple, makes a lot of sense. Like, of course you're going to do that. But they want to write it down, they want to create that rule so you can't argue about it later. So this first sentence is pretty simple. Clear and unambiguous language is always enforced as written. Well, of course it is. If it clearly says, I'm supposed to do A, well, of course both sides should say A. And that's what it should be. So it's a simple thing. Well, we want to establish that as that's the first level. If I see something in the contract that's clear and unambiguous, I'm going to design this for $10,000. Well, what's clear is that you're going to have to pay me $10,000. What's not clear is what this is. And so hopefully there's other descriptions of what this is. Or even if it says I'm going to design a house for you, you pay me $10,000. What's clear is I have to design a house for what goes in the house. That may need more information that needs to be put into the contract, but still that $10,000 is clear. So there's these kind of chunks you have to look at. So the clear and unambiguous language is always enforced. No explanations or clarifications of the language is permitted. So if you think about it, that example, I will design a house for you and you pay me $10,000. What's clear about that is the $10,000. So unless there's something that has happened completely catastrophic or different, you owe me $10,000 if I designed a house. And you're not allowed to say, well, I thought I was going to pay him four and then six or three and then seven. You can't do that because it says $10,000 if they design a house, if I design you a house. So that's clear, and you cannot give other clarifications outside of what's clear. Now, what's maybe not so clear, as I said, is the house. Well, what is the house? And is the house going to be a two-bedroom, a three-bedroom? Is it going to have one bathroom, a four bathrooms? What are all those things? There may be some discussion about that. But as your lawyer, as I talk to you as your professor and your lawyer, is you want to make sure, if you're the one paying the $10,000, that you're as clear as possible about what you want and what you're going to get for that $10,000. So maybe on another page, it's going to say the house includes three bedrooms, four bathrooms, etc., etc. And those also become your drawings. That becomes the part of the contract. The drawings actually become part of the contract. And so the more clear your drawings are, the more that they're clear and unambiguous language. And what I want you to understand, this term language for your profession is not just written word. Your drawings have a language all of their own. You guys are taught what a plan is. You know what a section is. You know what an elevation is. Those are all, it's the language of architecture and the language of construction. So a clear and unambiguous drawing is also going to be said. If it wasn't built the way it was drawn, the contractor then didn't follow the language of the drawings. And so there could have been a breach there between the contractor and the owner, because in the contractor-owner contract, it's going to say, contractor shall build the house in accordance with the drawings. And if the contractor builds in accordance to something else, they've breached the contract. So that's the thing. If you want clear and ambiguous, your language can include both written word and drawn word, or however the imagery is projected or presented as far as that. No explanations. You can't explain it away. But sometimes if something's missing, you can fill in the blanks. Now, why do we do this process of analysis? Well, if again, the simple thing is, if there is a fight or a discrepancy between owner and architect, owner and contractor, or even contractor and architect, even though they're not in contract, why do we have to have these rules to make sure we follow them first? So you say to the contractor, these drawings look clear. Your contract with the owner says build in accordance with these drawings. If you didn't, you have failed. And so it's resolving that conflict. Now, again, because we all know that architects' drawings are never going to be 100% perfect, or things may come up, like let's say you have a, like the house you're going to build has a basement, and so you have a foundation plan. The foundation is based on what was anticipated to be the soils, and maybe it doesn't have enough structural support. So when the contractor starts digging the hole and finds out that instead of lots of clay, it's silty soil, or there's problems with that, there's going to need to be more than what the drawings originally shown. And then that requires further interpretation, and we'll get into how that works later on about change orders and more money. But the point is that sometimes even the drawings that are created, because they're not 100% and they can't be perfect, those themselves have some ambiguity, and they can lead to changes in the contract. But the basics is what we're looking up here. Clear and unambiguous language, no explanations are allowed, and it's to resolve conflicts between the parties. Okay? Now, we talked about express terms last week, or at least an express contract. So you're going to have express terms in every contract. Those are the ones that are expressly stated. $10,000 is an express statement. A house is an express statement. It's not going to be a hospital. It's not going to be a strip mall. It's not going to be a gas station. It's going to be a house. But it may need more. They are spelled out either orally or writing. They're going to be expressed in contracts. Now, implied terms are part of the agreement, but not necessarily discussed and communicated. And you will have implied terms in every contract. Because again, and I'm not just talking about construction contracts, I'm talking about real estate contracts, I'm talking about business contracts and everything else. There are going to be implied terms because no contract could have every single item of every single part of every single deal and everything else. So, when we talk about construction contracts, what are the things that are implied? Well, I have a couple common ones up here that you're going to see. Neither party will hinder the other from performing the contract. I'm not going to come into your contract. I'm not going to come in and say, hey, or let's put it in a different, let me put it in a different context. So there's a contractor and they're building a brick wall. And I'm the owner. I'm not going to come in and tell the contractor how to do his work. If I start doing that, then I start taking both liability on myself as the owner, but I'm hindering them from performing their work. Or hindering could be, I'm not paying you because I didn't like the way you did it. Well, you're stopping the flow of cash. If they did it correctly, even though I didn't like it, if they built the wall in accordance with what's on the drawing, they need to be paid for it. So hindering is, it's not implied, it's not stated in the contract. It's not expressly stated, you must pay for this and this, or you were not allowed to tell them to do their work. But it's implied. Everybody knows that in construction. Another thing, construction will be performed in a good and workmanlike manner. So while like a contractor has to guarantee their work will, that the wall won't fall down, the roof won't leak, so forth and so on, they also must do it in what's called a good and workmanlike manner. You could have a wall that doesn't fall down, but it looks like crap because you got mortar dripping down, the bricks aren't put in smooth and even and parallel, they're crooked, things like that. That's not a good and workmanlike manner. So there's a certain amount of things where you expect things to look the way it should, and it's not necessarily written in the contract. It's implied. Who's going to hire a contractor that's going to put up walls that are crooked? It doesn't fall down. It doesn't leak, but it's not in a good and workmanlike manner. And so if the wall is crooked, the contractor, because it's still a term, it's an implied term, but it's considered a term of the contract, will be in breach because the wall is crooked. A third one there. Architect will perform its duties in accordance with the appropriate standard of care. Now this term standard of care, I have it right here, I don't have it capitalized. But you are going to see that, and hopefully you will see that, in every single contract that you ever sign as an architect. The standard of care is your, since you're not going to guarantee your work, the standard of care is the level that you are supposed to perform as an architect. And so, we'll come up later, it's going to be in, when we talk about the B101, I'll go into it in much greater detail, but the basics for the standard of care, as I said, is you are performing as an architect, so you have to perform at a level higher than the average Joe or Jane walking on the street. So you're held to the standard of an architect. That's number one, which is professional. Number two, it's an architect working on a similar project. If you're designing a house, You have to perform the work and the design in accordance with the house. It doesn't have to be the qualifications or standards of a hospital. It doesn't have to have the air quality and all the other stuff. So it's the architect performing a similar project in a similar location. You don't have to design a house in Illinois for the earthquake issues that you might have to design a house in San Francisco. So it's an architect performing as a similar architect performing for a similar project in a similar location. And those things come in. And like I said, even in Illinois, like if I'm designing a strip mall, I'm going to design to the standard of care of somebody designing a strip mall. If I'm designing a hospital, I'm going to be designing a standard of care of someone at the hospital, which is going to be different than the strip mall and different than the house. So that's what you have to perform your duties. That may or may not be in a contract, but it's always implied. And if you fail to do that, if you fail to meet that standard of care, then you're in breach of contract. This comes up often when there's going to be a lawsuit, and what ends up happening is you have to bring in an expert to interpret what's the standard of care. On one side, the architect's going to bring in their expert, and they're going to say, this is what the standard of care is that my architect that I'm being the expert for and testifying on behalf of them, they perform in accordance with standard of care. And the owner's going to put up their engineer, their special architect or whatever, and they're going to say, this is what I think the standard of care is. Because they're implied terms that standard of care isn't detailed, that's when the judge and the trier of fact and the judge and jury have to weigh that and say which expert makes more sense, which is more reasonable, which is more logical, because it's not clear. It's an implied term. It is, to a certain extent, standard of care has some ambiguity in it. But for purposes of just for generally what's going to be normally into what will be an implied term in the contract is that you have to perform to that standard of care, similar architect, similar location, for similar projects. Okay?
I have a question.
Yeah?
I mean, an implied term be defined by something that's outside of the contract. Like, say, on the architect's website, they do the best, highest quality of coverage.
Yes.
And then, like, in the contract, there's a standard of care dispute. Can, like, I don't know, Chase reference the website of the architect says something that we do the best, seamless, smoothest wall, and, like, that becomes something that's not really in the contract, but.
That's a great question. So, as I said, sometimes I'll repeat it. The question is if they're, for the recording, if the contract is silent on what the level of quality of the standard of care might be, but the website or the discussions or the communication between owner and architect is such that the architect presents themselves as the best in the industry, or we do the highest group, or whatever, can those terms that are not part of the written contract, can they become part of the contract? And the answer is, my two favorite words, it depends. However, I will say this. What will happen is while the contract says the standard of care, that term, as in, let's say you're the owner and the house or the building has poor design work, and the architect's going to say, but it met the regular standard of care. And you, as the owner, hired that architect because of they really were going to do the best of the best, their reputation, what's on their website, what they presented to you. I, as the lawyer for that owner, would argue that while standard of care is out there, this became because of the representations of the architect, whether it's by at the website, whether it's by communications or other. During those discussions, those became the standard of care by which this contract was entered into. Now, why it depends? It depends in that instance on whether the judge or the jury, and I want to say, believes you? Which side do they believe? Or do they want to? And the thing is our system is great, but it's not perfect. You may have a scenario where the contractor or the architect represented that they're going to do the best of the best. And the owner says, I hired you because I want the best of the best. But maybe during the course of the project, the owner is like not paying the contractor or the architect. The owner is going, well, I want this cheaper, or I don't like this. And the owner's not itself representing them. Can those facts come in? And maybe it has nothing to do with the contract, but as the cases play out, or the, not the cases, as the evidence plays out, that judge, the jury, the arbitration panel, they may say, I don't like this owner. This owner, even though this contract, this architect was trying to do the best, the owner kept making it cheap. And the contract's silent, so we can fill that blank in the way we want, even though the owner's like, I only hired this contractor because they said they were going to do great work. So part of it comes down to what they can hear and what they can't hear. Now, the hard thing is on the previous slide, that prior effect isn't allowed to substitute more words into it. So that's why our system isn't perfect. The flip side could be the other way, where the contractor says, look at my website, look at these beautiful buildings that I've had, look at these projects that I do. We only have the highest and the best, and the owner, and it's probably going to happen more this way than the other way. Most of the owners that you're going to have are not sophisticated in the construction world. I build a house once in my life, maybe, or I build my factory once. Contractors are doing it every single day. And so what may end up happening is that that contractor represents to the owner how wonderful their job is and how work is really great. Look at these wonderful pictures. And then when they get the job, they hire the cheaper subcontractors. And so now it's because he or she, whoever's running the business, figures out, I can make a better buck here because I'm hiring cheaper people, and it'll be fine. It'll look pretty, but maybe the walls leak or maybe the roof leaks or something like that. But that's okay because it looks pretty. And I'll put these pretty pictures up on my website. So you will find in the scenarios that are out there, because I've litigated this exact same issue, is that it's going to be more often that the people that are sophisticated in the industry will take advantage of the unsophisticated, which is often the owner. You can have sophisticated owners. It's the lawyer's job to try to figure out how to weave that evidence into the case, into the presentation of the case. So while the contract may not be clear on this issue, you put enough out there to create an understandable standard of care. In the owner's mind, or in the architect's mind, or whatever, this is what they really believed it was. Because standard of care isn't completely 100% black and white. So, does that help? That's an excellent question, because a lot of times that's where the dispute's going to come down to it. And how do we deal with these things like that? So, okay, so now we have some rules of how to interpret contracts, and I've given a little bit of a heads up of how we do it. How do we resolve these inconsistencies when architect and owner say A and B and contractor says C? How do we resolve those? How do we make sure that the contract, maybe it's not as clear, maybe it doesn't have the clear and unambiguous, maybe there's other things going. So, there's rules how we do this. First is you got to determine whether there's an actual contradiction or inconsistency. So, are the words, and sometimes this actually happens within the contract itself. There may be a paragraph that says A, B, and C, and a later paragraph says B, C, and D. Are the words within the contract inconsistent? Sometimes it may say A, B, and C, and it's missing D, but everybody thinks D is there. Is that an inconsistency or is that omission? So you have to look to see within the words themselves. Remember, we're interpreting the written language of that contract. If they're oral, it becomes much more difficult because people's memories become foggy and you don't have something down. But you're trying to see, is there a contradiction? Is there an inconsistency within those written words? And then, is there an interpretation by either contract rule, which we just talked about in the previous slides, or a judicial rule, and we'll talk about what that is in a second, that will allow those terms to be read consistently. If we have terms in the contract, actual written words, that don't seem like they match, is there a rule that allows us to put them together? So, sometimes you'll have the rules actually written in the contract. They'll state one document may supersede another. So you're going to have, in a construction contract, you're going to have the written words that talk about the business deal and who's doing what. You're going to have drawings, and then you're going to have specifications. I'm assuming you guys know the difference between drawings and specifications, right? Okay. So you may have a language in there that says specifications supersede drawings. So specifications may say when you're doing a window, when you're installing a window, it has to have this type of flashing. It could be a copper flashing for a high-end residential. It could be an aluminum flashing. It could have end dams. It could have certain types of things. That's going to be written in the written word. The drawings, because maybe the window's really tiny and there's only a blow-up, maybe only have a single line for what that flashing is. And the contractor is going to say, well, I can put in aluminum here. Well, if the specifications say it needs to be copper, or the drawings may not even go far enough to show where an NDAM is, or you're not sure, but if there's a the concept of an NDAM is referenced in the specifications, then the specifications, by what the rules in the actual contract, where it says specifications supersede drawings, then the contractor must follow those rules. So that's one thing that's within the contract itself. Requiring a lengthier or more expensive procedure. If I can install this window cheap and quick, but everybody knows there's two or three ways to install this window, there may be language that says the more expensive procedure is the one that has to be done. Maybe it's because you're going to imagine there's most owners aren't going to say use the cheapest procedure possible, because this is probably going to be a bad job. But you may see something where it says lengthier and more expensive procedure is first. That's how you interpret. And so sometimes you may have this drawing, or you may have some language in the contract that's silent or not clear. But later there's a term in the contract, so the specifications aren't as clear as you want. There's a term in the contract that says a lengthier or more expensive procedure should be followed. Then you interpret those specifications based on that direction. Or identifying who has the duty of inquiring about the inconsistency. So if there's like, and this is something that it'll say something to the effect of as possible. If the drawings are unclear, the contractor must submit a request for clarification of what those drawings mean. And if they go forward and build that, it shall be assumed that the contractor understood what the drawings meant. So let's say the drawings as drawn and the architect's intent of those was that the contractor was supposed to do A, B, C, and D. And that's what the architect and their standard of care and what they believe what the specifications say was our contractor, you're supposed to do A, B, C, and D based on my drawings and specifications. Contractor reads them, and they're not as clear as what they want. They're not really sure, and they don't ask a question. They don't raise their hand. They don't submit something called what's just an RFI, which is a request for information. And the contractor builds it, and they build A, B, and C. That contractor could be held in breach of contract because they have not inquired for clarification. They were required because the contract says if you have a question, you must raise your hand. And if you fail to raise your hand, you are assuming the responsibility that you understood. And so if there can be clarity shown by the architect that D was also required, the contractor is going to be in breach. And the result of that is the contractor is going to be responsible for paying for either the work to be ripped out and redone, or somehow making sure that the portion that wasn't performed is properly installed. So that's another way to clarify if there's inconsistencies in the contract. Telling people your job is the one to see the inconsistency and raise your hand. Make sense? Now, as I said, judicial rules. So a judicial rule doesn't even have to be in the contract at all. It's what the judge and what courts have said for years and years and years and years and years. So these, while they're not even implied terms, the courts are trained, lawyers are trained. If a contract's drafted, we, myself and every one of my other brethren lawyers, we have to follow the judicial rules in how to draft the contract. So, what's in every contract is the specific overrides the general. And that's why a specification is going to override a drawing, because the specifications, by their own term, is more specific. The drawings can be more graphic, but they won't necessarily say everything. You're not going to see in a drawing the size of a bolt or how you're going to do a torque, use your torque wrench and everything else. But in the specifications, if you're putting up a steel superstructure, you're going to see those bolts. You're going to see what the kinds they are. You're going to see what the torque wrench has to be set at. So that's why the specific rather than general. That's one thing that happens in every contract. Construe the language against the party who drafted the contract. Now, this doesn't happen as much as you might state or believe, because what courts try to do is they try to look at it as if you're in a written contract, everybody was on equal level. It's not going to be that David and Goliath type scenario. It's everybody's on an equal level. However, you can still make the argument if the contract says A, B, and C, and my lawyers, and I'm the one that pushed forward in drafting that, and it says A, B, and C, the court's not going to give me a break when I say I want it to be A, B, C, and D. They're going to be like, you could have put that in. You were the one that drafted that agreement. Now, the reason why the courts look at people on an equal level is because normally a contract will go back and forth and back and forth a few times, so we're all trying to get a meeting of the minds. But they still, the courts still can say, you were the primary drafter of this. You put what you wanted to put in, and I'm not going to add anything more. And then the last one up here, which is, again, a consistent rule, judicial rule, says, construe the contract as a whole, stating the provision that's more consistent with the overall contract intent. So you may see three or four provisions that talk about A, B, C, and D. And you're like, okay, well, which one do I use now? I got an A, B, and C here, and I got an A, B, and C here, and I got an A, B, C, and D here. What am I doing? Which ones? And so what the contract says is, or what the courts say in the judicial rules, let's take this whole contract as itself. Even though we're only talking about one provision, and they're supposed to follow this provision, does it fit with all the rest of the provisions? So if it makes sense, or is it the outlier? If it's the outlier, we're going to go with the intent of the whole contract over here. But if there's enough cues that say, when we look at the whole contract, that this one provision makes sense with these other, maybe the two outliers elsewhere we're going to get rid of. We're not going to use those in our interpretation. So those are some of the ways, as a lawyer, we think, we're still drafting as a whole. Provision by provision for certain things, but it still has to be this undivided whole. Okay? Now, sometimes, and I will say, in almost every single construction and architectural contract that you're going to have, there will be modifications. Now, there are fewer modifications made on the architectural side, but almost always there's going to be modifications made on the construction side. Because, again, you guys can't draw a perfect set with every single 100% details on it. Or, God forbid, an owner wants to change their mind. That never happens. So, there are going to be changes. And can you modify a contract? The answer is yes. You modify it by an agreement. Just like you entered into agreement that you're going to pay me $10,000 for the three-bedroom, two-bath house I'm designing for you, we can change that by a second agreement. Okay? The parties who sign the contract may always agree to modify the contract. I mean, that's about our business. That's about fair trade. That's about what people can do. I mean, if you guys both, if party A and party B say we want to change it, why should we stop them? You know? It's when party A wants to change and party B doesn't, that's when you get into some issues. But you can always modify a contract. And then, I talked about this, I think, maybe in the first or second class, I'm not sure. Even if the contract forbids modification, they can be modified. Because you have these terms in the contract that you agreed on that says, I agree, both parties, that we will not modify the contract. Well, why couldn't two parties come back and say, well, I agree that we're going to get rid of this clause that says we can't modify the contract, so we can modify the contract. And you can do that. Question? Great question. So the reason why you put in this contract and it cannot be modified in it is because you don't want one party to start trying to modify it by different ways. And so what normally you'll say is this contract cannot be modified unless and in writing specifically between the two parties. And that way, one side doesn't say, oh, well, I added an extra porch here so you owe me more money. And the owners will be like, I never had that. I didn't agree to it. So it's a kind of a roadblock. It also is to, while you're in the negotiation phase and the drafting phase, is also to try to get the parties to get as close to what the deal should be as possible in the beginning. But you're going to find many contracts where people don't want to modify afterwards. But in construction, because things come up, construction is never perfect, there's going to be tweaks and modifications. They're what's called, in construction, they're called change orders. So, this last one, there even can be an oral modification of a written contract. And you'll often see language in the contract that say, this contract may be modified by writing only. And then if the two parties orally agree to modify it, they can. And you're like, well, why would you do that? Well, sometimes that happens. But the reason why you put in the language that says this cannot only be modified in writing is at least one party will hopefully remember that and make sure to get it in writing. So here's a perfect example that'll come up. So, I'm a contractor. I'm working in the field. I got some problems with the way the plumbing's going in. Owner's visiting the site. They want to come see my house. And they're looking at it. And I sit down and I'm talking with the owner and I'm saying, you know, I think we need to change the way this plumbing works because of the way the stack is going and it's going to take longer for the hot water to get into this bathroom. than the bathroom next door because of the way it's routed. We need to do this change. And the owner's like, well, that makes sense to me because I don't want to wait longer than, you know, my kid getting hot water for the shower. I want to get it faster, so let's do that change. This all happened in an oral discussion. And they've agreed between that. That can be an agreement and a change to the party, to a change to the contract. And that may be all you need. What happens later is when the contractor says, oh my God, it was this and this and this, and it cost me $40,000 to do what you want, what we agreed to do. And it was like, holy cow, $40,000 to change so I get hot water? I could deal with waiting another couple minutes in the morning. I don't need this. And there's the dispute. So you have this language in the contract that says the contract can only be modified in writing. So what happens is the contractor writes what he does, and the owner thinks about it and says, give me a takeoff of how much it's going to cost. What's the estimate? And so you actually do the things you're necessary. So the owner says, oh, $40,000, now I don't agree. So some of those words in there of saying you can only modify it in writing is, again, is a cue to keep the guardrails on. Same for the architects. I mean, like, if you guys are designing something and the owner comes back and says, hey, I love these drawings and they're really cool and we're really close, we've been out to bid, but I want to add another bathroom. And so you go back and you kind of jigger the designs and you move it around and you add another bathroom and you bring it back and the owner's like, awesome. And then you send a bill to him. And the owner's like, well, it was just $10,000 for the house. Why would I pay you more? Well, you changed the contract. We thought the contract was three bedroom, two bath. Now it's three bedroom, three bath. That was a change to the contract. We orally agreed. We're all good. Here's my bill. The owner may say, but you didn't tell me it was going to be built. So that's another reason why you want to write that down. So, but you can modify it early. So, the other thing here, as I'm talking about here, the key is for modification, the timing is the key too. What you can have is you can have that, let's go back to that scenario where the plumbing stack was changed. And maybe it's not $40,000, maybe it's only $5,000. And the contractor, because they've talked to the owner and they know the owner really well and they've had a good relationship, and he's trying to be or she's trying to be helpful to the owner by saying, God, I want to make sure that the owner gets their hot water faster than their daughter gets the hot water in the morning. So I redid this and then sends a bill. But the owner hasn't been part of any of that. Now, the owner may be able to adopt it later on and say yes, but the contractor never got permission in the first place. So that contract has not been modified. No more money is entitled. The owner can say, thank you for changing the plumbing, but I don't have to pay you because you modified the contract before we had an agreement. So that timing of that modification in the agreement is very important as far as whether somebody's in breach or not. Okay? Now, so we're going to talk about what happens, because we talked about just timing there. What happens if there's a modification after the execution agreement, so after we've signed that and everything else, and reclamation of contracts. So reclamation of contracts is when those written terms of the contract do not accurately reflect the actual agreement reached between the parties. So maybe the lawyer did a bad job, or maybe there wasn't a lawyer hired at all, and maybe the parties just had this written agreement, they talked about it, they thought they came to the terms, and it wasn't written. And both parties say, even though the contract says A, both parties agree it should be B. And there's no discrepancy of what B is. So if the contract says A, it's not B and C, it's supposed to say B. You can reform the contract. That way we get clarity because that was the original intent. I will say reformation in my 35-some years of being a lawyer, I think I've only been in one contract issue where we talked about reformation and we were able to work it out. But reformation is not a common thing that happens. Now, one could argue that the scenario where the contractor changed the plumbing stack for $5,000, if the owner came in later and said, oh, that makes sense. One might try to argue that's reforming the contract because the contract didn't talk about the changed plumbing stack. But it's really just actually what is called a ratification, which we're going to talk about that in a little bit. So, with reformation, though, you need a lawsuit seeking reformation and making the only time that the court can rewrite the contract. So you can't, if you're going to have the parties just say, if the contract says A, and the two parties say it really should be, they can agree to that themselves. But sometimes it may require but you have to formally change that. That may come in a government contract scenario, or it may be because if you're at a corporation, you're dealing with a board of directors and they have bylaws and rules on how to change contracts. So sometimes you may have to have a lawsuit. So the only time, and that's what I said, I've only had one scenario where reformation was an issue, and it specifically requested the court to reform the contract. And then there's a lot of hoops and hurdles that go through to make that reformation. Sometimes what you're going to have in that reformation is, even though they both say B, there's a little difference of what the B is, just a little bit. And so the one party or the other party is going to be kind of squabbling over it, and the court still has to come in and sort out what B really means and create that reformation. But you're not going to see that very much. The party seeking the information in the reformation must also have a good reason. So they have to say it's a mutual mistake of fact. We both thought it was B, not A. We both were misunderstood. Or sometimes there can be a reformation if one party committed fraud. You know, like, if I was defrauded and I still want parts of the contract enforced, whether it's their obligation, the other side's obligation to perform something, create the work, but they defrauded me, maybe they gave me false bills, you know, whatever it might be, the court can reform the contract to make sure that it's taken care of if there's fraud going on. And then the unilateral mistake of fact, where only one party was mistaken, sometimes, but very, very rarely, you could have reformation of that. But the other party needs to know that the first party had the mistake. So they're almost being taken advantage of. Not necessarily defrauding them, but they're like, oh, if that's what they believe, that's fine, but we're going to do this, this, and this. So the court will step in for these reasons and reform a contract. But again, it's very, very rare. And I will tell you that you don't have to worry about knowing a lot of details about reformation for the exam. But I just wanted you to know that this is something that does happen. Okay? All right. So now we're in a scenario where the two parties, they've entered into a contract. We all know how to interpret that contract, how to figure out inconsistencies. But something goes wrong. There's a breach. So what do you do when there's a breach of contract? So let's talk about first what a breach is. A breach of contract is as simple as the failure of a party to perform or fulfill its promise and or obligations of the contract. You paid me $8,000, not $10,000. You've breached. You designed me a house that had 3 bedrooms, 2 baths. I asked for 3 bedrooms, 3 baths. It breached. You designed a wall that fell over. It's not according to the standard of care. Breach. You built a wall as a contractor that fell over. It didn't follow the drawings of my really excellent architect. Breach. Some party has failed to do something and perform an obligation under it. That's the first step. And so that promise or that obligation, if you remember when we went back to the claims, you have duty, and the second step is breach of duty. Well, there's the breach. So we have the duty. That's what the contract establishes. What are the parties' duties to each other? The breach is the failure. So we're now second step in that claim process. Okay. So what do we have then, contract remedies? Because now you have an injury. An injury in this case is in construction. It's not going to be a physical injury necessarily. It's going to be, oh my God, I have a wall that needs to be knocked down and rebuilt. Or I have a house that leaks. Or whatever the scenario is, I have to hire a new architect to design because the first architect was so incompetent. That's your injury. And what do you get from that? Well, you get damages. And what are those damages going to be? So how do you get made whole? Okay? So that's what a contract remedy is. It's to put the innocent party in the position he or she would have been in had the contract been fully performed. So that's what you want to do. We all agreed in the beginning for the contract, we had a meeting of the minds, we wrote it down, that if I paid you $10,000, you would design me a house. That's what we all agreed. That's what we want at the end, and how do we get there? So we want to make the party, the innocent party, whole. And the other thing about contracts that people have to remember is that it's not about punishing. In fact, punitive damages are traditionally not allowed in contracts, in any contracts, not just in the construction industry, but any contracts. Because, and I say usually because there could be something written in there, but the reality is that it's about commerce and making people come to an agreement, and then having business or whatever going forward from that. So then there's different types of remedies for contracts. The traditional that you're going to hear of is a legal remedy, which is monetary damages. To make me whole, I designed that house for you, I need to get the full $10,000. Or, the other way around, I paid you $10,000, and to make me whole, I still need the house fully designed. I may need to go out and hire another architect to finish what you did, and someone has to pay that other architect to finish that, because I've already paid my $10,000. To make me whole, I still have to have the full design. So, that's going to be done by money most of the time, legally. Equitable damages. Equitable is an action, not monetary. You guys may have heard from things from time to time where in the news where somebody comes in and they try to enjoin someone, they try to stop something from happening. That's an equitable remedy. I think I told you the story about, did I tell you the story about the collective ceiling plan? The company that I represented that had the light ceiling plan and they hadn't been paid? Okay, let me tell you that story, because this is something I'll use over and over. So, one of my clients came to me and they were a very well-known lighting system company. And so they were hired by an architect as a sub-consultant for them for a very large complex to design all the reflective ceiling plans and all the way the light systems work and everything else is very complex for this building. And they do all the drawings for those. So the architect was doing the floor plans, the elevations, and everything else, but all the reflective ceiling plans were drawn by my client, as well as the specifications that went with it and everything else. The client wasn't getting paid because the owner wasn't paying the architect. The project had already started. My client was out about $450,000. The client, the lighting company, came to the architect and said, "You got to pay me for all my work." The house was a large office complex. It was under construction. Like, they're building this. I got to get paid. The architect's like, "I'm not getting paid. In fact, I just got fired." And so there was no money to get from the architect because they were owed money by the owner. And the owner was screwing them over. Owner went in and hired a new architect. The new architect took the drawings from the first architect, which included in that set of drawings my client's reflective ceiling plan, put them on their papers, and in the title plaque put their name, and they became the architect of record, so there was a copyright violation. Not only for my client's drawings, but for all of them, and the construction was on its way. And so what my client did, and what we did, we sat down and talked about it, is like, well, you're not going to get money from the architect. The architect's out millions right now. So that's trying to get, blood from a rock or whatever that cliche is. So we need to figure out what the best way to do it is. So we went in on an injunction for equitable relief. And we sued the owner and the new architect for copyright infringement. And we asked the court to stop the project, because in construction, using those copyright drawings and building something isn't in itself an infringement. It's not like they're copying it onto other things, although they did physically copy it onto other things, but using it to build the actual construction is a copyright infringement if they don't have permission. The project was shut down. My client got paid in 2 weeks. So we got money, but the court didn't award us money. The court awarded us an injunction, meaning they stopped the construction of the project. I don't know what happened after that, because my client got paid, but I know there was a whole bit of mess between the architect and the other one and everything else, but at least my client got, because we were able to stop. That was an action as opposed to monetary. Question?
How is injunction enacted in the U.S.? Is it like
dangerous? How is it enforced? Is that what you're asking? Yeah, an injunction can be enforced by... what will happen is the court will set down an injunction, and what will happen in the very beginning is what's called a TRO, or temporary restraining order. That's the first step. And there's a temporary restraining order. If the other side violates the temporary restraining order, then the lawyers will go back in and show proof of the violation, and then at that point in time, the court will award monetary damages for each and every, sometimes it's every minute, Sometimes it's every hour, sometimes it's every day that that injunction, that temporary restraining order, has been violated. And the dollar figures can be substantial depending on what's at issue. And so now you have a court that's specifically fining, even though it's, we're not supposed to have punitive damages in the contract itself. The court now has the authority because the court says, you've ignored my rule, and the court will put punitive monetary damages and fines against that entity. And then someone can go in and foreclose on that. So there's lots of steps to ultimately get to the money, but there are very serious risks for that. And then what ends up happening is the temporary restraining order may be in place for 2 weeks, 2 months. It's a limited period of time. Then the courts, then if it's not resolved because of the heavy weight of that temporary restraining order, which happened with my case, it was 2 weeks. But if it's still continuing and everything's kind of stuck in the mud, nobody's moving anything, then the party that asked for the temporary restraining order may actually go in and ask for a permanent injunction. So in my case, if we had to go in for a permanent injunction, because we originally got a TRO, if we had to go for a permanent injunction, we would say this project would never be built. We are shutting down this project entirely until everything is. And then I would seek attorney's fees, and I would try to seek sanctions, I would get my $450,000, and so it would become very messy. So there can be, in certain situations, if the injunction or the TRO has to do with, I won't say necessarily like picket lines, but has to do with where there's physical barriers. Sometimes you may have the police that will help be enforcing that, but that's many, many steps down the road. But normally it starts with the TRO and then proof of the failure to file the TRO and then fines coming from that. Okay? Any other questions on that? Yeah, two of them. You go first.
How did your client get?
They got a check. That's how they got paid. Oh, well, so we didn't sue for the money in the court. What we said was we want to stop this project right now because of copyright infringement. And so then what we would have had to have proven later down the road is that there was an infringement of the copyright, and then we would have had to show our damages of that. Now, the interesting thing is the damages for the infringement of the copyright was much less because the way copyright law is, and we'll have a lecture on this in the second half of the semester, but the law is about statutory damages and everything else. So I knew that the dollar value, and we had just gone in on this, on an action for copyright infringement, I would have known that potentially my damage recovery for my client dollar value would have been significantly less because of the way the statutes work than had I stopped the project. What ended up happening with stopping the project is this owner was now paying for hundreds of workers because I stopped the entire project because it was the ceiling for every room in the place. So I shut everything down. It was the electricians, it was the plumbers, it was everybody. And so this owner now is looking at a scenario where he's got this, he's got hundreds of workers that have nothing to do with the ceiling plant and he's paying them to sit around. And that, because they can't work on the project. I mean, maybe they could, they couldn't lay carpet, maybe lay carpet, there's some stuff that could be done, but nothing with respect to electrical and because behind, I mean, if you guys look up here, you're going to see plumbing, you're going to see other things that are, but this is the ceiling that would be a drop ceiling, but we have an open ceiling here, but you know, you got the fire protection, which is in red. There's lots of things that are going on that has nothing to do with the lighting. So it cost the owner so much money, and I knew that leverage. Had we had to go all the way through, we would have modified our complaint and tried to get the monetary and everything else, but we went to them and said, pay us our $450 and we'll get the TRO lifted and you can go back to build your project. So it was the leverage piece more than anything else. But you're right, I didn't ask for $450 in my suit. I said in my suit that we were owed $450,000, so that was in there, so everybody knew what it was. But my suit was for the copyright infringement and would have been the damages from that. So the first architect was fired, and we worked for the first architect. The new architect came in and took the drawings from them. My suit was against the owner and the new architect. The owner was the one that's going to get hurt the most because of all the money they're paying all the people on the contract going on. The owner and the architect could have their own fight with each other. The other architect and the new architect could have a fight with each other. I don't care. My care was getting my client paid as fast as possible. So I used the power to that. I named both parties that were infringing. I don't know if the architect wrote the check for $450, the owner wrote the check for, I can't remember. I mean, this was years ago, but I think it came directly from the owner. But however they figured out their squabble, I didn't have to worry about it. So, question. Okay, good. All right. Last one here, the consequential liquidator punitive damages. Now, I just said you can't have punitive damages in contracts, right? Well, you can actually in very limited circumstances. We'll talk about that. Consequential damage, liquidated damages, I'm going to tell, I think that's on my next slide. No, but I'll tell you what they are briefly. We do cover those later, I think, but it's not the next slide. So, punitive damages is punishment, so there are certain ways. If people defraud you, you can get punitive damages, and sometimes you may hear the word treble, which is three times. So if you're damaged $10,000, you defraud, you've defrauded somebody for $10,000, you may get awarded, the party that was defrauded can may award $30,000 because it's treble damages. You have to prove the fraud, there's certain statutes that come into play. Normally you're not going to have a punitive clause in your contract. Liquidated damages, however, is another way to get around this concept of no punitive damages. And we'll cover it more, but I'll just give you a simple example of what it is. One of my clients, I may have told you, is Haribo, the people that make the gummy bear candies. So like that factory that was built, I don't know if any of you guys have seen it, you're going up to Wisconsin, right over the Wisconsin line, it's on the west side of the road, there's this giant factory that says Haribo. The letters are probably like 30 feet tall. So we built that. Haribo needs to make candy. They need to make candy and make money. So they need to have the factory up and running at a certain period of time in order for them to start making money. And part of that is built into the way their budget's put together, with the promises they've made to their end users, what they've made to the board of directors, the people that run the company, blah, 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 blah. For every day that that factory didn't open and wasn't making candy, it's losing money. Based on the projections. I mean, it's not technically losing money because it's not selling anything it wasn't selling before, but that's the concept. For every day that it wasn't making candy, it was losing money. So we had a liquidated damage clause in the contract that said, you must finish by this date, and for every day you were late, you have to pay us X dollars. Now that sounds like a penalty, right? It's not, because what you do is you try to figure out what those X dollars per day are is based on the value of the sales of the candy that Haribo would have lost. Let's say it's $10,000 a day. If Haribo lost $30,000 a day, they could only ask for $10,000. If Haribo lost zero, they could ask for $10,000. Because it's an agreement at the very beginning, and it's based on time and other restrictions that are very clear in the contract. And so we'll talk about that a little later. I'm pretty sure I have a slide coming up, but that's one of the other types of damage. It's going to be a monetary one. So it falls under legal, but it's based on the contract. Consequential damages are much more kind of for many people like grabbing smoke. They're not as clear. It's not a direct damage from the contract. So a direct damage is, this is the best way to put this. Okay, so we use the same concept. Haribo needed to open the factory, okay? And we have liquidated damages based on them not selling candy. But let's say the factory's not open in time, or maybe the reason why the factory's open and it's running, the wall falls down inside where the president's office is, okay? The direct damage is to rebuild that wall. That's a direct damage. The consequential damage is the president had to rent a trailer on site so he could be there and run the company. The cost to rent that trailer, which has nothing to do with building the building, has nothing to do with rebuilding that wall, is a consequence of the fact that the president's office wasn't ready. That's considered a consequential damage. So could we recover the $5,000 a month for renting that trailer? Possibly, and it depends on what the contract says, but that is another type of damage. Consequential damages are indirect. It's a result of, but it's not directly related to what the project is. Don't worry about the discrepancies on that. We're not going to get into consequential damages on the test, but I want you to understand that that is something that's very common in construction. In fact, so common, you're often going to see a construction contract that says the parties are not entitled to consequential damages. They don't want to get into the grabbing smoke, so they eliminate it specifically. That's very common in construction documents. Okay, so for monetary damages, that was the first one. For breach of contract, the first type you're going to have is expectation damages. That's it, making the innocent party whole if the contract was performed. Expectation damages is the most common awarded. So, you design me a house, you design everything I want, you expect me to pay $10,000. I don't like the color of the brick, so I'm going to pay you $8,000 instead of $10,000. You expected to get $10,000. The court's going to award you $2,000 more from me because you expected to get that. Injured party recovers the difference between the cost to complete the contract by another and the agreed on cost that the original party has performed. Let's say, in the same scenario, so the expectation is you get that $2,000, but let's say in the expectation damages, let's put you guys in a different situation. You are the owner now. You've hired me to design that house. And it turns out that I'm super busy, and I'm doing the house, and I screw up on a few things, and you're like, this is terrible. Like, I violated some code, my drawings are what, it's just not working. And I'm not timely, my drawings are poor, I'm just not doing my job. I breached the contract because I'm not doing what I'm supposed to do. You still expected, as the owner, to get these drawings, this house, for $10,000. You paid me $4,000. Because that's all I've deserved. That's all I've been owed because I've been such a slacker and I did such a bad job. Now you got to go out and hire somebody else because you're like, I can't work with you hand in hand. I got to go hire somebody else. So you go out and hire another architect to finish my drawings. That architect says, well, I can only work with some of this because it's so bad, but I'll work with what I can. It's going to cost you $14,000. You've already paid me $4,000. So now you're paying $18,000 for something you thought you were going to pay $10,000. You pay the guy the $14,000. You get good drawings, your house gets built. But you're out now money because you paid me $4,000 and you paid him $14,000. So you sue me. What do you sue me for?
Eight.
Why eight?
To make it
whole. But why? Why is it making you whole? Why is it making you whole if you sue me for eight?
Because we were looking at
10
total, which
is
what I originally thought.
Exactly. So what the original deal was for this design, I spend $10,000. I ended up spending $18,000, $4,000 to me as a slacker and $14,000 to somebody else. So I paid $18,000 for what I thought I was going to pay $10,000. The difference between what I thought $10,000 and what I paid $18,000 is $8,000. It's not the difference between the $4,000 and $14,000, although that could be another way to look at it, but the reality is I paid a total of $18,000 for what I thought was going to be $10,000. I get the difference between those because to make me whole was a house for $10,000. Does that make sense? You get what you expected for the value to which you agreed. That's expectation damages. Okay? Most common. And while I say there's no math involved in this class, there may be a question on this, and it's a kind of simple math problem. So, but that's your expectation damages. Monetary damage is also, there's one thing called reliance damage. Reliance damage is awarded to the injured party who foreseeably relied on a promise. Sometimes it's even unenforceable. So you acted because you relied on a promise by another party. You did something because they told you, I'm going to pay you if you go cut my lawn. I relied on you to pay me $20 to cut the lawn, even though you didn't give it to me first. Even though the contracts are legal because I'm a minor, I still relied on you. You owe me $20. That's reliance. You get what you deserve based on that promise. My example here is I'll pay for the car that you go out and buy. Go out and buy me a car. Like, I'm not saying anybody would go out and buy their friend a car and expect to be paid back, but maybe, I don't know, maybe that guy works at a car dealership and can get the car dealer discount and he has to buy it for himself on his own papers and then sells it to you. You relied on being paid back when you bought this car for your neighbor and they don't want to pay you. I also call it, as I said, I want my money back remedy. As if the contract was never performed. Like, I relied on you and you didn't do it, so I want my money back for what I gave you. That's another way. If I'm going to pay you to do this, sometimes it happens the other way. I'm going to pay you to cut my lawn, but you never did. Give me my money back. I relied on you after I paid you to do something, and you failed to do that. So it's as simple as the term. You relied on somebody, and you want to get back to what you relied on. Restitution damages, last one up here, is A order where one party has provided a benefit to the other, and the first party is compensated for providing that benefit. This is another thing they call unjust enrichment. Did I talk to you about the putting the shingles on the house yet? Did I do that one yet? Okay, so that's where there could be, where the contract is, where the guy came in, and this happened in my house, where they were putting up shingles to take care of a leak in the house. They saw another place over there that was leaking, or could be leaking, and they fixed the shingles in that part of the house. We didn't have a specific agreement for him to fix another part of my roof. But our agreement was kind of unclear. It wasn't in writing. He was a guy that came in and said, I knew it from a guy that knew it from a guy, and so I hired this roofer, and I said, I need you to take care of where the leaks are in the house. I didn't know where they were leaking from, and neither did he, but he came in and he did the investigation. He saw where the primary leak was, but he saw something else where he thought it needed to be done. The contract itself was not as clear as it could have been, and they performed a job that enriched me. Now I have another place in the house that has new shingles. If I didn't pay him, he would say, I'm unjustly enriched, I got more work from him, I got the shingles, and he wants restitution. Restitution is paying him for that benefit that I received. Okay? They are compensated for that benefit. Recovering from providing the benefit if the contract was actually performed, e.g. the house burned down mid-project, this is another way you can get restitution. So let's say I'm building you a house, and during the course of that construction, it's struck by lightning, an act of God. It's not because of my negligence that I had bad wiring and I caused it. It literally is struck by lightning, and the house gets burned down. And I've done half the work. You still have to pay me for that work. Even though it doesn't count for you, you have nothing there, you still have to pay me because I'm not at fault and I've incurred losses. I've paid workers. I've had monetary costs in my materials. You need to pay me. I need restitution for that. And you're going to say, well, how was I benefit? How was I unjustly enriched? And that's where restitution comes and gets not as clear as you want it to be, but the reality is that I have been not paid to a detriment. And I want to have restitution, and I want it to restore so I'm at the equal. And I know that lightning struck, but we probably needed to make sure there was insurance, whether I'm carrying the insurance or you're carrying the insurance. That's where the payment should come from, but I still should be paid for the work I did under a theory of restitution. It's not reliance, it's not expectation, because neither party caused the defect, or the damage is caused by God. But I still get restitution. Make sense? Okay. Now, as I said, equitable remedies, we talked a little bit about this already. So remember, the monetary is the court side monetary damages. Equitable remedies, injunction, which we talked about. I can go more into injunction if you guys have more questions, but that's the first one. Rescission. We talked about that last week, I think, with the house that I had with a client that was down at the bottom of the hill where the subdivision was in the basement leaks. We sued for a rescission of that contract. And that's undoing the contract and returning both parties to pre-contract status quo. It's like the contract never existed. The court, based on the facts and the scenarios, will rescind it, will pull it away. And so the parties are like, I never bought that house, and I never paid you because you gave me the money back, and you never sold me that house, like it never happened. Rescission is very difficult to get. You can sometimes base it on fraud. I don't believe that the guy that sold this house to us was trying to commit fraud, or to my client. But there was enough evidence that we felt that showed that he, this developer, was aware that these houses at the bottom of this cul-de-sac, because it wasn't just my client's house, it was the other houses there too, were having water infiltration problems. And so there was enough there that what we did is we looked at the court and said, you know, we could go in and we could battle this out and we could look at the cost of ripping up the basement and redoing all this and blah, 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 blah. Or we can get the parties back to their decision, the status quo. And the court said, because we had literally moved in and only been in there, my client had only been there for like 2 weeks, and it rained and it was really bad, the court said, let's just go back to the very beginning and do status quo. It's only for something unique also. land is considered unique. Even though, and this is the hardest thing for people to kind of, not the hardest thing, this is an interesting way to kind of look at it. Buy a condo in a condo building. I used to live up in Roscoe Village on Roscoe Avenue. There was a pencil factory loft, and it's got this big like water tower on top that's painted like a pencil. They used to make Ticonderoga number 2 pencils. I knew all about that. But they developed it and they made it into these loft type spaces with a high ceiling and the exposed brick and everything else, and it was like condo, 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 condo. Every single condo looked exactly the same. But under the law, every single condo was unique. They are a unique feature. Anything that has to do with property, land, real estate, even if it looks exactly like the one right next door, is considered under the law unique. And that's why you can get rescission under a contract dealing with real estate. And that's where you're going to see it more than anything else. If you're trying to get a rescission for a contract to supply oranges, that's not necessarily, you can get another supplier to supply oranges, or you can get the money for the oranges that didn't come through. The courts don't look at goods and materials and commodities as unique. Land is. You also cannot have a specific performance. Oh, wait, did I jump down? I'm sorry. Rarely sought award. I jumped down there for a bit. Some unique and specific performance. Let me go back here. Rarely sought award. Unique, this concept here, sorry if I confuse you guys, this concept here for unique does apply to rescission too, just so I want you to know, with land, so even though I jumped down. But I do want to talk about specific performance. That's requiring the performance of a contract. So specific performance, that's another equitable relief. You must finish this. So let's say that the contractor is building that house for me and they don't want to put on this X type of roof shingles. I can require that contractor by specific performance that they must put on these shingles. You must complete the contract as written. So that's, again, also something unique at this specific time. So specific performance will work with rescission and with, or I'm sorry, the uniqueness concept works with specific performance, and it will work with rescission when you're dealing with land. But it has to be a unique requirement for specific performance. I'm going to specifically require you, the courts can specifically require you to do this. So in construction, because it has to do with real estate and property, that's why they may force specific performance because of the unique nature. It can happen in other things. I'm trying to think what else. Let's say that you're buying a certain type of hat from a factory. They only make these kind of hats from this one factory. And you got into a deal where you're going to buy a gross of those hats, and each hat you're going to pay $10 because you can sell them for $30 out on the market. The company that sells the hat got a deal the next piece when it came, because there's such a small market for it, everybody wants them, blah, blah, blah. The next person who came down the line says, well, I'll pay you $20 a hat. So the company that makes the hat is going to start selling it to the second person. And you're not getting your hats. But nobody else makes them. Because the company's making more profit. They're going to sell them $20 a hat instead of $10. I can go into court and say, I can't get these hats anywhere. I am requiring specific performance. Not only must they sell me my hats per my contract, but they must sell me for $10. And the people that are getting, that they want to sell for $20, they're just going to have to wait because of the uniqueness of that hat. So that's a specific performance on a commodity that you can do. You can never have specific performance on services. If you hired, I'm trying to think who's a, Sabrina Carpenter. If you hired her to come in because you're really rich, you're super rich, and you're hiring her to sing for your daughter's 16th birthday party. And Sabrina, because you have millions and millions and millions of dollars, and she's the one that's going to sing for you. I only think of Sabrina Carpenter because my daughter's 14 and she listens to her all the time. Sabrina Carpenter doesn't want to sing for that. She entered into the deal. She wants to do that. She doesn't want to sing. Maybe she's got another gig. Maybe she's like, I don't want to start being phoned out for 16-year-old birthday parties. Whatever, my agent told me it was something different, blah, blah, blah. And you're going to now go to court and you're going to sue to get Sabrina Carpenter to sing with that, because I have a contract that says I'm going to pay her $10 million. She must sing with that. Court will never enforce that. Even though you're asking for specific performance, even though it's unique, there's only one Sabrina Carpenter in the world, That's considered indentured servitude. That's slavery. You're not allowed to do that. Even though they're getting paid for it, you cannot force someone. Now, the interesting thing is, construction services, the normal construction services, laying bricks, putting in plumbing and everything else, that specific performance can be enforced because it's building a house. They take a look at it as a bigger area. So there are services where actually people are performing labor that can be enforced, but it's different than individual services by someone in the world, or even a group or something to that effect. So, any questions on that? This is, as I said, I knew we were going to get to this slide. Other types of damages for breach of contract. Consequential. They're indirect damages remotely caused by the breach. They must be foreseeable, though, to recover. They can't be so far remote that no one would expect it. So that example is, like I said, if the president of Haribo can't move into his office, but he still has to run the business because his office isn't finished on time, and they have to rent a trailer, that's foreseeable. He's on site, he's able to do that, he can run the factory. What wouldn't be foreseeable is if they put him up at the Ritz-Down in Chicago, which is 60 miles away, and he's working out of there, and we have to pay the prices for the Ritz. Yes, accommodations are reasonably foreseeable because they didn't finish the factory on time, but the type of accommodations isn't reasonably foreseeable. So you can have those consequential damages. The purpose is to cover the damages that are the consequence of the breach, but they're not identified in the original agreement. Nowhere in my contract with the contractor that built our facility said, and oh, by the way, if you're not done on time, we get to put my president up in the Ritz, or we have to rent a trailer. Nowhere is that going to be written in, because who would do that? Lost profits. That's a consequential damage. As I said, if the facility isn't open, they couldn't sell candy. I know it's a candy factory, but the sales has nothing to do with the construction of the building. It's a consequence of the factory not opening. That's considered a consequential damage. So without some other mechanism, like the contract saying we get these consequential damages or otherwise, Haribo cannot sue for those lost profits or loss of business. Like a loss of business, here's one for specific for you guys as an architect. So you come to me, or I come to you, and I say, I want to hire you for you to design me this casino. You guys are really good in the casino business. And so you're going to design the casino, and so we start talking about it, we get into the ideas and everything else. And I'm like, I want your A-team, and we're going to start working on it, and it's going to go in, because we just passed some new laws here in Illinois, we're going to put it up, this casino's going to be great in Chicago, blah, blah, blah. We start working on it, and then I lose my funding. So I don't pay you. I'm going to be able to get the money. I got some backers coming in, I got some venture capitalists, we're going to get the money, and then I don't pay you another month, and another month. Well, at some point in time, my failure to pay you is a breach of contract. Now, what ended up happening that I didn't know is when I was trying to hire you, Harris Casinos came to you and said, we want to hire you because you guys are the best casino designers out there. And you're like, I can't take this job because I already told Hanahan and his investors that I was going to design their casino. So you lost the job. And then I breach. Now you're not making money from Harris. You're not making money from me. The damages that I didn't pay you, the damages from me that I didn't pay you, that's a direct damage. The Harris Casino job that you lost is a consequential, that's a loss of business. You cannot recover. So there's some differences between that, okay? Like I said, well, you cannot if it's been disclaimed. And I say it's often disclaimed in construction contracts. No consequential damages. So what do you do now? Like, how do you protect yourself if you're the candy company or you're the architect or you're like, I represent a lot of companies or have throughout the year, energy companies. So we build these giant power plants. So they're supplying energy for thousands of people in the area. And if that power plant isn't online, if that candy company isn't online, we're going to lose money. Harris is going to lose money selling candy. Con Ed is going to lose money selling energy. And a lot of people are going to be pissed off because they don't have their power. Or Con Ed has to buy it from one of their competitors, because that's how the way the grid works and everything else. I don't want to just take this risk of potentially not getting something back. How do I protect myself? I protect myself with what's called liquidated damages. Liquidated damages is a per day, sometimes it can be per minute, per hour, but most times it's per day, value where an actual damages later would be difficult to calculate. Like, it's hard to calculate how much sales really would be of candy. Are they going to sell 100 million units right away? Or are they going to be like ramping up slowly? We're not really sure of what that is. It's hard to calculate if the factory's not done in January versus May what the dollar values of lost electricity. So what we do is, and those are all consequential damages. So even if we agreed we could have a limited consequential damages, you're not really sure what those are. So what the parties do is first of all, the contract, they write it language in the contract that says liquidated damages will be X. It'll be a dollar figure, it'll be a time component. We'll have both dollars and time. Most of the time it's dollars and days. Sometimes it can be dollars and, like I said, minutes, hours, or otherwise. Cannot be a penalty. The language must say in the provision, this is for the purposes of covering these losses and is not considered a penalty. And both parties have agreed that it's not a penalty. So if you guys ever have a liquidated damage clause that you see, maybe one of your clients says, hey, can you review this construction contract? And it doesn't have language about it being not a penalty, raise your hand and say, we need to have penalty language in there. So it cannot be a penalty. It has to have some reasonable relationship to the likely or potential damages. So even though you can't exactly calculate how much loss of candy revenue or loss of electricity revenue, there should be some models where they can base it on. And it'll include also I have to keep different insurance going. My bank loan may be different. There's more components that come into it. And the dollar figure must be calculated and inserted in the beginning of the deal when the contract is signed. So like I said, if it was $10,000 a day and Haribo lost $2,000 a day, they still get $10,000. If Haribo lost $14,000 a day, they still get $10,000. It's agreed to in the beginning. You can't go back later and say, well, I don't like what my liquidated damage amount is. Some of the ones that I've worked on, I worked on these power plants. Those were somewhere between $250,000 and $500,000 a day. I did a casino. The amount of money that was lost, and by the way, it would never have covered it. It would never have come close to what the value of the company was going to lose. We had a casino that we were building down in New Orleans. The liquidated damages were $1 million a day. They did the calculations of the casino of what they would lose if they weren't open, and it was closer to $10 million a day. Just from the one-armed bandits, just from the slot machines, they made like $7 million a day profit to this casino. But the most they could get is $1 million because no contractor would sign themselves up for $10 million a day to bankrupt them. But you can have these astronomical figures, millions, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars per day. And I had to collect those too. It's kind of surreal, but it happens when projects are late. And on that, really one simple note, what I would say to you guys, the most expensive breach in construction is time. Because you have to pay the workers to sit around and do nothing. You lose money. Like, time damages, the biggest cases that I've worked on are largely due to time, not poor work. Now, I've worked on big cases where it's crappy work and you got to rebuild things. And those are big dollars, too. But time is, when they say time is money, that's so clear in construction. It's huge. Question over there. So that's a great question. Would a consequential damage or a liquidated damage clause, would they be more in an owner-architect contract, more in an owner-contractor agreement? You're going to see about 90% of them are going to be in the owner-contractor agreement. You may have consequential damage loss in an owner-architect agreement where the time factor that handles for architects is when are they supposed to have the drawings ready. And if you are late for when the drawings are ready, because a lot of projects nowadays, sometimes construction started and you're still drawing because they've started on foundation or early stuff and they do what's called fast tracking. If the drawings aren't ready, then the contractors just sit around and wait for those drawings. And it's not the contractor's fault, it's not the owner's fault, so the architect has to pay for that. So you're going to see some time liquidated damage provisions related to timing of when the drawings are going to be done. And there may be some consequential damages, but much less in the consequentials, because there's fewer things that are going to happen because of late drawings other than a monetary liquidated damage. But I would say of my contracts that I've drafted, which are in the thousands over my career, I'd say 90% of the LDs and consequential damages fall on the contractor's side. So that's a good question, though. Okay. We did talk, like I said, about punitive damages. They are almost never awarded for breach of contract, sometimes for fraud. So that's why you have to have that language in the contract that says these liquidated damages are not punitive, because the courts don't allow punitive damages in contracts. But if there's a fraud, most states will have a statutory or case law that says if you've defrauded someone, you can recover more as a punitive. Punitive damages, you might want to think about similar like paying a criminal fine. But in that instance, it's paid to the other party, to the contract, and not to the state. So in a state situation where you may have a punitive damages, here's an example where, as I said, I worked with these companies that make these power plants. One of the things that with the power plants, because the power plants that I've worked on are a turbine. So what you have to do is you burn coal, and the coal heats up water, makes it to superheated steam, gets water up to steam up to about 1200 degrees. It's in these really super compressed pipes. Those pipes let the steam out, turns the turbine creates electricity. That's as simple as you ever want to think about it. The concept of clean coal, we've heard clean coal, there's no such thing as clean coal. Coal is dirty, and when you burn it, it puts off certain ash and everything else. Clean coal is you take that dirt, that smoke and everything, and you pipe it through these filters and these other systems. And that's what we also build. They're called the AQCS systems, air quality control systems, or scrubbers. And you put that coal and the smoke that comes off of it, you put through. So sometimes you guys may have seen driving down the highway, and you may see these tall chimney stacks with this white billowy smoke coming out of that. That's all steam, because what happens is that has been cleaned, all the coal has been cleaned, and all the soot and the ash has been separated out. Some of that ash and soot they use to make drywall, interesting. Some of it they use for fire suppression systems. There's a whole bunch of stuff that they use those byproducts for. But sometimes you're still going to have things where that air that's coming out doesn't meet the EPA's requirements. Or there's water that's discharged that may discharge into the local water systems that has too much particulate in it. And in that situation, the owner, the company that is creating the electricity, ComEd or whatever it might be, they're going to be fined by the government for a failure to comply with EPA or other regulations there for their discharge. In my contract as ComEd with the construction contractor, I'm going to say if I am fined by the government, you need to pay those fines. And you pay them to me, not to the government, because I have to pay them to the government. The government is fining me. That's punitive. I have broken the law, and I'm getting punished for putting out air particulate or water particulate in excess of what's required. That is a punitive penalty to me. You paying me back is not punitive, but it kind of feels like punitive. But you have to pay me because you have violated your factory that you built, or maybe you're the designer. A lot of times these high-end facilities are design-built, so it's the same company that designed it and built it. Those people will have to pay you back as a part of the contract, even though it's not punitive, so to speak. Does that make sense? Okay, legal fees and costs. That's one of the type of damage that comes into a construction contract. If I have to sue you and I'm the innocent party, I don't want to pay my lawyer because I didn't do anything wrong. You did. You need to pay my legal fees and their costs, all their factors and cab rides and steak dinners and whatever else they did. You need to pay my legal fees and costs, my expert that I have to hire. However, they're not awarded normally in a breach of contract unless they specifically state that they're allowed. So if the contract is silent and says nothing about legal fees, both parties have to carry their own legal fees. They have to pay their own lawyers. They don't get it from the other side. But the contract may say legal fees are awardable to the owner, and only the owner. That's when there's like an unbalanced position. Sometimes you have, that's the David and Goliath, where the contract says, I'm the big, massive, giant owner. I'm Microsoft. I want, and you're a small little contractor. I really want the job. Only Microsoft gets legal fees, and the little guy doesn't. Sometimes it says, legal fees will be awarded to the prevailing party. Sometimes there's cross suits against each other. So, like, if I'm suing you for $1 million and I recover $200,000, and you're suing me for $100,000 and you recover $400,000, who's the prevailing party? Is it because I've recovered $200,000 and it's more and you recovered $40,000 of the $100,000? So it's $1 million to $200,000 and $100,000 to $40,000. If I recover $200,000 and you recover $40,000, am I prevailing or are you prevailing? Is it 20% and you got 40%? Or is it 200,000 versus 40,000? Those are all going to depend on what the courts want to look at, what the states may want to do. Sometimes the courts may say neither of you guys prevailed because you guys neither you got close. 40 is not close to 100 and 200 is not close to a million. You guys both have to pay your fees. I'm going to ignore that cost. Judges have a lot of leeway on legal fees costs. But you can't have them. But the only way to recover legal fees is it has to be written in the agreement. That's why you're like never going to see legal fees in an oral contract, because the one party that has to pay it's going to be like, I never agreed to that. And how do you prove it? So you're going to only see it in writing normally. Questions on that? Okay. Last slide. Litigations of damages. So we've always been talking about this whole time in class, we've talked about the innocent party, the one that has been damaged, the one that's seeking restitution, rescission, equitable relief, whatever it is. What do I get to make me whole? Do I have obligations, though? Do I have a responsibility to mitigate damages? And the answer is yes. The innocent party has to act reasonably. The breach by one party does not guarantee that you get the whole kitchen sink. I, as the innocent party, have to do something to stop the blood flowing, to keep the damages to a minimum. I must take steps to minimize my own damages. So I represented a company that I got brought into it way late into the dispute, but they made ethanol alcohol. And not ethanol for gas, for not the alcohol to drink, but for the gas station. So they made ethanol for like for the pumps. And which is made from corn. And so their facility didn't operate properly. It operated at a substandard level where it still made the ethanol, but it didn't make it as pure as they wanted it to. But they could still operate. Before I got involved, they shut down their facility. And they were going to try to recover all the costs of the damages for them not being able to sell their ethanol, because they couldn't make it to the pure grade that they wanted to. Now, it wasn't so impure that they couldn't sell it to the public. They just had to sell it at a discount. And so I told them when I came in and we started working with them, I said, you need to start making this ethanol because you are not mitigating your damages. You can sell this product, so you have to sell what you can. You can't recover 100 cents in the dollars. You can recover 30 cents on the dollar. And that made them have a different perspective about how to handle the lawsuit. Another project I worked on was there was some problems with the contractors, their ability to meet timeliness and schedule. And so this was the owner, and they were building this facility. And the owner was in the contract in the stages of whether they were going to terminate the contractor or not. A bunch of steel had been delivered to the site. The steel was sitting out there waiting. And while they were trying to figure out whether the contractor was going to do the work or not, and they ultimately did fire the contractor, the steel sat out there, and it was unprotected. And this was over a period of many months through the winter. Well, that red steel rusted, and some of that steel wasn't viable, and they couldn't use it. But it had scrap value. It had value. So we had to put a price on the value of the steel. Even though the contractor breached, even though the contractor didn't do its job, the contractor arguably was the one that also should have covered it in the beginning because it's their materials when they bought it on site and everything else. But once we got to this point where we knew that there wasn't going to be work going on and the steel was sitting out there, it still had some value. So part of our mitigation of damages is that instead of keeping rusted steel there and giving away, we sold it. And that reduced our damages because we got some money for that, and we mitigated our costs. So that's something. We were the innocent party. We ended up winning in the lawsuit. We got a lot of money from the contractor, etc., etc. But it wasn't going to be as much had we not sold the steel. But I think that helped us in our case because we presented it. In this case, it was just a judge. We presented to the judge, look, we did best we could. They ruined the steel. We sold it. We have less damages. So those things. So you have to do that. It's a significant issue, like I said, in the construction case. I just gave you two examples. I have many of them that come in. And you really, the mitigation concept is you can't take advantage of the other side because they breached. You have to be reasonable and responsible on your side. So, any questions? All right, that's it for today. See, I told you I'd get you out early.